Greetings and welcome to the Bible Unbound podcast, the Book of Revelation. Today we're going to take a look at the situation in the church at Ephesus as it is still under the threat of having its light removed from it. So Jesus had said that there were many good things about Ephesus, but that there was one thing that was at fault. And so he says in verse 4 of that chapter, "But I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first." And then, of course, he gives them the correction, which is to remember, repent, do, or he would remove the candlestick. So we saw over the last couple of weeks what happens when the light can tend to go dark, both individually, church-wise, corporate-wise. But the situation is triggered. It's not something that just happens automatically. When the lights go out individually or church-wide, corporately, and we've all seen that, when it goes out, there's something subtle that has happened. Something has died. Something is disconnected deep within the soul. And that's what Jesus perceives in the church at Ephesus. You have abandoned the love you have at first. Well, we're going to go into a live discussion of what this actually looks like. I hope it will be beneficial to you. Welcome to the Bible Unbound podcast, the Book of Revelation. What is it to have the lights go out in a church? What is it to have the lights go out? But rather than just go over what we did last week and look at the condition, the symptoms, the very, very, very sad narrative of what it is when something goes from light to dark. That's what it means in verse 7. I'll remove my candlestick. You remember chapter 1 and verse 20 says that the candlesticks are the churches. And the churches represent light, a candlestick. When that light goes dark and that candlestick is removed, Jesus says he does that. And he does that when? Let's just read the section. You guys put it together. We're going to discuss this. The bulk of our time today will just be discussion. So Revelation 2, 1 through 7, "To the angel of the church at Ephesus write the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the golden candlesticks." Now, notice, Ephesus was a good church. It's one that if you and I were to look at it, from all that we've heard in terms of their reputation, in terms of their activity in the community, what they're involved in terms of their discipline, their patience, their endurance, it's one I, for one, would want to join. And Christ describes that at this section, verse 2. "I know your works, your toil, and your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and found them to be false." I kind of like this church. Verse 3, "I know you are enduring patiently and bearing up for my namesake, and you have not grown weary." Wow. Steadfastness. Great church. Verse 4, "But I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first." I want to suggest that's the trigger for the lights going out individually, the church, in a culture. Common grace, the inroads of paganism, neo-paganism, this is the linchpin. You have abandoned the love you had at first. That's the key note. And then there's the corrective. Remember, "Therefore, from where you have fallen, repent and do the works you did at first. If not, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. Yet this you have, you hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." We could stay here for months just looking at all the various details that were occurring there at the church at Ephesus. We could define Nicolaitans. We could define what it is to eat of the tree of life. We could define what it is to be such a steadfast church. But we've just kind of, because of time, had to isolate down to these two thoughts. We already looked last week at what it is for the lights to go out. Today, we want to examine why the lights tend to go out. Jesus said, I have this against you. You've abandoned the love. Abandon the love you had at first. And then he tells them, remember, first of all, repent. Second of all, do the first works. Thirdly, or you'll go dark. So this is kind of, today is kind of a roadmap on how to stay in the light or how to return if the light has grown a bit dim. It'd be either one. And that's what Jesus is covering here. So we're going to talk about love, all the admirable qualities. There was that little thing that happened, that little kind of imperceptible, it would be imperceptible pretty much to the human eye. Something has transferred, something has shifted, something has grown cold, something is different than it was at the first. Let's talk about what that first love is a little bit. The word protos is used, meaning first. And in the Greek, the primary usage of protos means chief or highest or most important, highest in rank. But it's got a close second cognate usage, which it means in order, it's in sequence. The first. Not the second, not the third, but the first. So it could mean either one. And commentators kind of go both directions, but the majority of them do come down that really what it means is chief or highest in rank, highest in order, or most important. So in other words, it would be that Jesus is saying, I have this against you, that you have abandoned the most important thing of all, the love. And so what does that look like? I've got five things that I have reflected on that for my past 44 years of being a Christian that I have noticed, but they're just my five. You guys could probably add about what it is and how to make sure that we don't engage in any of this abandonment of first love. Now, again, let me just illustrate one thing, because a lot of Christians will kind of trip up at this point and assume that what he's talking about is sort of something you can feel, an emotional thing, and they try to identify that emotional thing, and some of us have had dramatic conversions, as opposed to a very subtle, maybe we're raised in church, and eventually we realize that I am a Christian. But some of us have had dramatic experiences, and with that dramatic kind of Damascus Road experience, we did have a great emotional sort of honeymoon. And some people will think, well, that's what he's talking about. But that's not, because Jesus does not say, remember from where you have fallen and feel the same feelings. You want to say, he doesn't say that at all. And in fact, he doesn't say, believe the same things you believed at first. So it's not a denial of the faith, and it's not an erosion of the feelings. It's something else. If you are doing some background study on this material and you go to the number one commentary on the book of Revelation, which is G.K. Beale, both his larger 1,300-page commentary on Ephesians. He's got a shorter, more summarized one, 300 and some pages. If you go to that commentary and you see what he describes as losing your first love, it's exactly what Brent just said. And he comes down pretty hard on that. Hendrickson might come down in a different place, and Olin might come down in a little bit different place, but most scholars pretty well reserve their opinions until G.K. Beale has spoken. He's not alive now, but, you know, when he did. And it would be just what Brent said. It has to do with outreach. And one of the things, one of the five descriptors that I have written down here, pertains to that specifically, at least in terms of its outreach and its how it comes off. It's number five. You'll notice on your second page, carelessness. I don't want to trigger anything that's going to make me go full-on practical atheist. So in other words, practical atheism is the problem. Practical atheism. What is practical atheism? You all know what atheism is. Fool, Psalm 14 says, in his heart there is no God. Okay? So practical atheism is when we do not adopt that creed, but we live that creed from time to time. One of the ways in which we live that creed in saying there is no God is that we say there is no God right now. Not here, not in my presence. And so we deflate him like a balloon, push him aside, so that we can comfortably move forward, and then at an appropriate time, we blow them back up again. After all, I am a Christian, and I can't imagine living without God, so I'll re-magnify him and give him his prominence, but not till I have accomplished and oftentimes indulged. And one of the primary ways where it comes out is in the area of personal witness of Jesus Christ. Can you imagine if you really believed in hell? What would that do in terms of your neighbors? What would that do in terms of your coworkers? What would that do in terms of the people you rub shoulders with? Do you really believe that Christ's love is really all that consuming, and that his forgiveness is absolutely everything he says it is, and that his love is this fourfold dimensional height, width, breadth, and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you might be filled with all the fullness of God. If you really believed that, and I really believed that, why would we dare drain the magnitude of God for the sake of my own, I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to feel uncomfortable. At this moment, and a little piece of self-preservation like Peter at warming his hands at the fire outside where Christ was under assault and he backed off, self-preservation, save his own skin, acted like Christ was not all that Christ, what he knew Christ was. And we can do that. How many times as men have we done that in order to entertain porn or some kind of sexual thing or anger for our wives, knowing that if Christ were to manifest himself in the presence right there where I'm speaking those words to my wife, we would be different. So this practical atheism, if we were as conscious of God in his presence as we ought to be, because we're Christians, so we're not atheists, we tend to go atheist at appropriate and convenient times. And Beale says that that is what was occurring there at Ephesus, and so their witness grew cold. Because when you are more concerned about saving your own skin or not being rejected by the eyes of men, when the fear of God is this level, but the fear of man is this level, we've got an inversion. Something is then triggered. Something has happened. And I'm right there with, I'm telling them myself, you know, these 5 points came from my life experience. I know. So if any of you are convicted by this, I'm with you 100%. And it's something we have to resolve. As I'm speaking about these things of self-preservation and not wanting to be ashamed or rejected, if you're feeling that same thing, I mean, it just proves the point that I'm not the only one in this room with problems with insecurity. Mm-hmm. and feeling ashamed and letting the bubble of the magnitude of God just go small so I can skirt through this season, you know, where I'm, as I don't know that we have that luxury anymore in our culture. And I think that that's one of the reasons why our culture is where it is because the church at large, Larry, we could take your concept and magnify it even to the universal, or the church, evangelical church in America has really been afraid. Last week, I showed you a tweet from Emerald Robinson where she said, "Hey, Christians, because you were willing to tolerate homosexuality, you ended up with transgenderism. And because you were willing to tolerate transgenderism, now you've ended up with approved pedophilia." You could go back to the 70s and say, because you didn't stand up as you should have against killing and murdering innocent children in the womb, you have Roe v. Wade. Because culture is always downstream of the church. That's just the way it is. Jesus said, My kingdom is the light set upon the hill, and it will determine the course of the culture. And so what has happened in evangelical America over the last 30, 40, 50 years is how the culture ends up going. As the church, we have tried to shape ourselves according to the culture rather than standing in opposition to the culture. And you just don't find that in, like, persecuted churches. They don't have time for that. Why would we waste our time trying to look like the culture around us? The culture is persecuting us. No, we're Christians. We're different. We're intended to be different. We're salt. Some of you will be able to relate to what he had to say. I asked him for permission. He said I could read his letter that was personal to me. See if you can't relate to some of this. "Jim, I am closing out completely my career at the university at this point, still teaching a relatively difficult and sizable class that is consuming way too much of my time. It, my career, and my activities there will be finished in 6 weeks. Hence, I am frantically trying to discard and pack 46 years worth of material, papers, reports, notes, books, computers, stuff, dating all the way back to undergraduate college days. I don't believe you ever saw my office, but it was not small and is, or now was, crammed from bottom to top. I have hauled so much from state to state and position to position and office to office over the past 5 decades. I have to be out of the office by the middle of May or so. It's not a trivial process. Jim, there's nothing so depressing." No, not depressing, more enlightening, actually, "as to go through the flotsam and detritus of one's life and realize the futility of so much of it. Things that consume so much time and effort and energy so many years ago that seemed so vitally important at the time, now destined for the landfill, to rot in dampness and darkness. Ecclesiastes suddenly becomes so very relevant." That's his wife, "is worried about me being depressed about it. But I think it is more a kind of revealing of truth to me. And with every box of discarded records, I feel lighter, freer, to be honest. If Malcolm Muggeridge, famous journalist, had not already used the same title for his autobiography, I think Chronicles of Wasted Time would work quite nicely to describe the bulk of what I have done over the past decades, years, weeks, days, and hours, minutes of my life from the time I was a youth to the present day. One thing is sure, there will be a big bonfire very soon in the corner of a pasture here." He owns a nice farm. He says, "in the corner of a pasture here, where at the end of this process, I bring home those records and papers that must be destroyed and cannot simply be discarded. I hope I do not choke to death on the smoke from all my vanities, mm-hmm. although I would surely deserve it. Mm-hmm. He is having a reawakening in his life right now. He is, this is not his most recent letter. If I read to you his most recent letter, you'd be amazed. He's having a revolution. And it's a good illustration of what it is to remember, repent, and do the things that are most important. And yet he has to do it with this wild scene and the smells of the acrid smoke and the, you know, tons of books. And what did I do? What's it look like when a man goes on autopilot? Well, Psalm 73 is all about this guy who looked out and evaluated his world, and he came up with the conclusion that, you know what? The wicked are doing good, and the wicked don't ever have to pay a price. The wicked are fat and happy, and the wicked, they don't even act scared when they're about ready to die. And he brings up all these things, and he says verse 14 here, for all the day long, I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. And he said, you know, it's so different for me. I'm struggling. These guys aren't. And that was his worldview. And that's how he thought. And he woke up with those feelings. He went to bed with those feelings. He wrestled all the day long with those feelings. And in verse 15, he has enough light because he's a godly man. He has enough light. He says, if I had said, I will speak thus, in other words, if I go around telling people that this is the way it is I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand all this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Trying to figure all this out. Why is it this way, Lord? I don't get it. He said, it wearied me to be about this business of so unfair, and it's so... Verse 17, here it was. Here's his transition. This is where my friend, who I read his letter, this is where he's at. Until I went into the sanctuary of God. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then and only then did I discern the truth therein. It's like he went into an IMAX at this point in his life, and he sat down, he was all alone, here's this theater, and all of a sudden everything starts breaking open to him. You set them in slippery places, you make them to fall in ruin, you destroy them in a moment, they are swept away by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. And that realization then, that he was not taking the view from God's eye, rather he was taking the view from his own eye. He was on autopilot. He was stuck in this mode of thinking. Now look at his reflection in verse 21. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was, and this is key, brutish. I was like a beast before you. You see what he's saying? What he is now discerning is that there are two modes of mentally operating, two modes of cognition that I realize now. One is the cognition and the mental processing of a godly man with a God's eye view. The other is the cognition of a beast. And how does a beast act? Stimulus response. Pavlov's dogs, you remember. They don't rationalize. They don't think. They don't reason. They don't go three-dimensional. They don't go deep. They don't ask why. They just do. And so when a man is stuck, and I used to call it the Joe Sixpack mentality, you know, he'd go to work and he'd stop at the bar, or he'd stop and grab his six-pack. He'd go home, he'd start breaking open the six-pack. turn the TV on, watch his Netflix, and then he'd go to sleep at night, and he'd wake up in the morning, do the same thing day after day after day after day. Head in the sand. Stimulus response. Whatever's presented before him, he responds to it without thinking. And so what this psalmist is doing is he's saying, no, I'm not going to go beast mode anymore. I'm going to go God's eye view, the mind of Christ, the eye of the perspective of the worldview that's rich in the reality of what God has constructed behind the scenes, mostly. So we hope you've enjoyed this podcast episode, and we trust that you will meet with us again as we join together to discuss the situation next time, the church at Smyrna in Asia Minor. Till then, we trust that you have a very blessed day in the Lord, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.